And then I know Ian will be – Ian Solomon, who's the U.S. Executive Director from the bank, will be joining us in a few minutes. So I'm Dan Rundy. Those of you who know me, I hold the Schreyer Chair here at CSIS, and it's really been a great honor to be hosting this conference on fighting corruption with our partners at the World Bank. And I wanted to particularly thank Leonard McCarthy, who runs the Integrity Vice Presidency, as well as his communications advisor, Dina El-Nagar, who's really helped us to get this together. And so it's really been a wonderful partnership. And I think many of you know that INT spearheads the anti-corruption and transparency efforts at the bank group. And the World Bank has been leading anti-corruption efforts in development over the past few years. And President Kim talked about the Anti-Corruption Hunters Alliance, There's, of course, the Stolen Asset Recovery Initiative and the Open Development Platform, which we're going to hear more about over the course of this panel, but I think also on the next panel. And I think corruption is defined by the World Bank as the abuse of public office for private gain. It's a global phenomenon which impedes growth and perpetuates poverty and feeds political instability by undermining faith in institutions. And I think one of the things that the bank has done is measure the costs of corruption. That it's one figure that's been talked about is $1 trillion. And I think that's been one – and I think we'll get a handle on some of the costs and implications and the size of corruption, I think, over the course of this panel. And I think we're going to have a much more – a very detailed discussion in the second panel about how we respond. What are the responses to corruption? I think we'll also get into some of that here as well. But I think what the stakes are, I think the stakes are quite high. And I think in a period of development austerity, in a period of where we're reducing the amount of money that is going to official development assistance or could be reduced, that those who have disagreements about the use of development assistance use corruption as an excuse, have used and will use corruption as an excuse to cut foreign assistance budgets, whether it's in multilateral contexts or whether it's in the course of or bilateral context. But also, what I think the bank has done and what other research institutions have looked at is as President Kim talked about, that it's an important subset of the good governance agenda, and that good governance is what is implicit to societies being successful. And it also, and corruption scares away private investment. It robs the poor of their dreams. So the stakes couldn't be higher, both politically and developmentally. But we'll have a chance to unpack that further. The good news is, and we'll talk about this in the next panel, that there are solutions, and I'll make some comments about that in my remarks at the beginning of the next panel. But I'm not going to make any further remarks. I'm going to hand the floor over to each of our very distinguished panelists. You have their biographies in the packet in front of you. But I'm going to first start – I'm going to ask each of the panelists to make an opening statement or some opening remarks from their perspective about this issue of the stakes of corruption from their perspective, and there and some very interesting perspectives here in the, you know, on this panel. And then what we're going to do is we will then have a conversation among the panelists, and then we'll open it up for Q&A. So without further ado, I'm going to hand the floor over to Dr. Kaushik Basu. Dr. Basu.
Thank you very much, Dan. Thank you also for giving me the opportunity to be here and speak on this very, very important topic. Corruption is an innately difficult topic for two reasons. Conceptually, it is hard. It is not as easy as people take it out and make it to be, because in life there are lots of quasi-corrupt activities take place, and it shades from one shades into the other. And you have to draw a line, which is a difficult line to draw on a slippery slope. People say we shouldn't be on a slippery slope, but life is on a slippery slope, and you have to draw a line on a slippery slope. And I will give you some illustrations of why conceptually it is difficult. Also, it intertwines with a lot of legitimate activity. You hear this, what you just mentioned about using corruption as an alibi to cut off lots of good things that we are doing. Very often you will also hear that in emerging countries, that why not close in on bank accounts of domestic citizens internationally? In today's world with global business, there's a lot of legitimate business activity going on around the world. You can't just go around and assume that it's all tax-evaded money that has been parked elsewhere. So there is a line drawing which we have to face up to. Number two, the problem is with data and information, because by its very nature, It is something that is subversive. You can't go to a household and, like, you can do a survey on consumption, you can't do a survey on corruption by asking questions, because you will not get an answer. So you'll have to think of indirect ways to get answers. And as a consequence, this is also an area which is mired in rumors and truths intermingling together. You know, there was a beautiful remark I was remembering in Private Eye, the British satirical magazine, talking about how American journalists are endlessly fussy about double-checking facts, whereas we at the Private Eye believe that some facts are just too good to be double-checked. You know, this is sort of sums up in a difficult area like this, that when some facts are just too juicy and would make news, there's a lot of media that will run with it without double-checking. So it is a very difficult area. And this also addresses something which, in my previous work in India as advisor to the government, I would face up all the time. Huge amount of civil society activism in India, and that's very desirable. But one thing you have to understand, that civil society activism and passion has to be combined with professional position about how you tackle this problem. You can't just say that it's dreadful, it's visible, so it should go away. Yes, I mean, you all agree it should go away. And even where you see corruption, you'll probably find a vast majority of bureaucrats who will not be corrupt, who'll be fastidiously honest. But it intertwines. So that's the difficulty. World Bank has done exceedingly good research in this very, very difficult area. And we have numbers. Dan just mentioned this is World Bank Institute's research shows that the total amount of bribe per annum is $1 trillion. But here is, again, one difficulty that you have to understand, that a bribe itself is not an economic cost, the way we talk of economic costs. A bribe is a transfer of money from one hand to another. An economic cost is something which leads to fewer goods and services. People have less welfare. So in itself, that transferring of the money itself is not a cost, but it does do a damage to society, and a profound damage to society. And from my point of view, the damage is deep enough when you have this, that whether or not it oils the economy, as some very conservative thought would say that bribery is good, it oils the economy and makes it run faster. Well, it may oil the economy, but it does so much damage to morality and fundamental values of a society that I feel it has to be fought at every level. But it has to be fought intelligently, it has to be designed intelligently, and I will just refer to one historic remark. This is David Hume in the 18th century, drawing our attention by saying that, look, every time you see a problem, to bring more policemen to try to solve this will not do, because there is a question of who will police the police. And indeed, that is an endless problem. Every layer you create, and very often in emerging economies, the mistake that you've made is you see a problem, you bring in a new layer of bureaucracy, new set of rules, and you get another layer of corruption occurring above that. So this needs to be designed very, very carefully. I have in the past stuck my neck out on some design issues and got into some dreadful controversies. I will not get into those controversies over here. But I feel you have to combine these. You have to have the passion and the anger about corruption. But with that, you also have to bring in a lot of cool-headed thinking. Let me just point to one more thing. People usually think of there being a lot of correlation, and indeed there is correlation between a country's welfare, economic conditions, and corruption. And usually the more industrialized countries have less corruption. There is a correlation over there. But it's by no means a perfect correlation. And our studies show that among emerging economies, there are striking exceptions with low corruption countries, Botswana, Chile, Costa Rica, Uruguay. So you have, it's not tied to your state of development. Yes, there is a relationship, so you may have to fight harder, but it is possible to do better. Let me stop with that, and I might come back on other things later.
Thank you, Dr. Basu. Dev.
Thank you, Dan, and also Kaushik for that incredibly impassioned introduction. I'm gonna put my hat on and approach this from what I'm hearing from some of my clients, right? Mainly in the private sector dimension, but also in the public sector, because I represent that segment in the bank. I think when it comes to corruption, the bottom line for development is this, that corruption impedes economic growth and job creation as well, and we accept that. The president mentioned that earlier as well. Now, Kaushik addressed the damage that it does to society. From a private sector dimension, where do I see this damage coming from and the cost of corruption? I think in two ways. Tolerating corruption promotes basic distrust in markets. Right? That's what I see right at the heart. I can't put a number on it. Right? It is not easy to put a number in it, but it promotes basic distrust in the market. And number two, the scorn for the rule of law. Right? And the moment you put both of these together, it really erodes the very economic foundations, right, from which private sector can thrive. Right? Just these two, and I'm sure there are a number of other arenas that we're not touching. But at heart, you know, at root, I think these are two critical agendas. By contrast, how do we maximize benefits? I think taking the decisive steps to ensure the strong ethical standards are inserted into society is absolutely a critical need to buoy up confidence, promote enterprise, and help create jobs. Now, the question that I then want to answer or try to bring forth from the reflections that I'm seeing and observations that I'm seeing from others as well, and I do not want to say that these are bank views. So let me be very clear. I just want to throw them out, and we could have a discussion on that. How do you actually maximize development effectiveness, right, by controlling corruption or even trying to eliminate it? There's 6 points that come to mind. One, I think the fight against corruption needs to be a collaborative effort. You cannot, put it on one constituent, right, versus another. I think it's the way the governments come in together with the private sector, how civil society, plays a role, as well as financial institutions in general. So that collaborative effort in trying to thwart corrupt activities is, I think, a critical dimension. Then my president, earlier, President Kim, indicated, and this is the second point, that we have to keep in mind the link between corruption and governance. That is an incredibly important point to make. Recognizing that basically corruption thrives in the absence of good governance. Right, so you've got to have the good governance element to come in importantly. Now, that would call then for such priorities as having broad public disclosures, right, on what's going on in society. I think that is a critical dimension. Number three, let's not forget that corruption takes place all over the place, right? So let's not forget for a moment that we don't have to deal with corruption in the so-called donor countries as well, all right? And I think this is something that we need to put up front. And so the continuous changes that are required, even in this country, right, on the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, etc., is critical to send the right signals that this is an important agenda item. Number four, the proactive efforts that the private sector needs to itself pursue, right, in tandem with government-led efforts. And you could say that it's almost in the enlightened, self-interest of the private sector to do this, right? Because it pays off in profitability, right? And here there is direct evidence of how private sector can enhance its returns on investment by tackling corruption. And on this, I won't go through the details, but just look at the banking industry, right, and what's been happening there lately. And here, you know, just adapting to the good practices, right, that needs to be made in the banking industry is a critical dimension. The extent of money laundering activities, right, that comes into play that the banking sector itself fuels. Now, there have been a number of studies that have shown that direct interventions by private sector banks themselves, right, in trying to contain these issues have paid benefits to them. Number five, measurement. Again, you know, this is not a bank position, but I am quite passionate about it, and I have you know, almost daily discussions with my dear friend Leonard over there, and that is the importance of disclosure, right? Of, for example, what if we went tomorrow and insisted on asset disclosures, right, of all politically important people? Make that public. You know, how much was that individual worth before he or she joined politics? How much are they worth after? But make that, you know, a bold effort. And it's not, by the way, just for the World Bank to do this. This is where it really requires partnerships to come in, because it is not an easy problem to solve. But I do happen to believe in call it what you like, naming and shaming if you want, right? But this is important enough an agenda item such that we tackle it head on, and making it having these disclosures is absolutely critical. Sixth and last point, and I'll actually not dwell on it too much, is that the existing international anti-corruption standards must be strongly enforced. There are several reports that the bank has issued. One of them is the recent report by the Stolen Asset Recovery Unit of the World Bank Group on the puppet masters, right, who basically manipulate corrupt financial flows behind the scenes, that report revealed the way in which very often countries hide behind the legal superstructures, right, on corruption, and how do we in fact tackle this? Another point that we've talked a lot about the issue of beneficial ownership. That definition of beneficial ownership has not yet been clarified, right? In other words, when we face complex issues in trying to even retrace stolen assets, right, and getting into who the beneficial owner, right, of a particular asset is a complicated exercise, especially when you have offshore centers. There are other, you know, legal entities that you can resort to. So the moment you cross jurisdictions, it becomes an almost impossible affair, right? So I think that here on the legal community has got an obligation to come together to tighten the rules a little further. Let me stop right there.
Thank you very much, Dev. My friend and colleague, Jerry Hyman. Jerry.
Thank you, Dan. I'm in week number five of laryngitis. So this is going to hurt you more than it hurts me, but I will try to follow through here. I guess it's obligatory to talk about the cost of corruption, so I'll just add a couple of pieces of data here, too. Not that you need to be convinced, since otherwise you wouldn't have been here, but Global Financial Integrity estimates that $6 trillion in the 2001 to 2010 period has been lost to crime, corruption, tax evasion. In 2010, $860 billion was lost to the developing world, and that was 20 times the official development assistance number of $40 billion. So 20 times as much as of the total amount of OECD a development assistance was lost to corruption, crime, illicit transfers, and so on. The response to that, I think, has been mostly looking at institutions. And it derives really from the idea, goes way back, that corruption is a crime of calculation, not of passion. And therefore, if you change the institutional rules, you change the rules of calculus, you will also reduce corruption. And Klitgaard's famous formula that monopoly plus discretion minus accountability is how you get to corruption. And so therefore, if you can reduce monopoly and reduce discretion and increase accountability, you will also reduce corruption. One peculiar element, I think, of the state, which isn't often commented on, is that the state, unlike private monopolies, has coercive power. And therefore, it can force you to be participant in corruption, even if you are not yourself a direct participant by taxation, a whole variety of other ways in which you wind up supporting the corruption of, let's say, the defense industry or any other industry through the coercive power of the state. So the state corruption has a particularly corrosive dimension. And all of that leads to things like special prosecutors, corruption commissioners, debarments, as President Kim said this morning, courts and police, transparency, disclosures, things that were discussed here today. Lastly, there is, of course, a moral dimension to all of this, and that is the issue that you raised, the extent to which corruption corrodes the morality, the legitimacy of state institutions and of the markets and of a whole variety of other social institutions. But it seems to me that this institutional approach is really a bit insufficient, and that is because there are at least three conundrums I'd like to put on the table. First, if corruption is a crime of calculation, how do you change the calculus if the calculus is constructed by the very people who are the beneficiaries of corruption? This is sort of a political economy conundrum. The people who are who most benefit corruption in most of the whole world, and certainly in the developing world, are precisely the people who have the ability to change the rules. So to go back to the first sort of institutional economics argument, it's all very well and good to say change the incentive structures, but who's going to change the incentive structures, and especially who's going to change them if the incentives that are currently in place benefit the people who are charged with changing the incentives? So that's the first, I think, conundrum, and it tends to be solved, if you like, if that's a proper word, by the collapse of the corrupting elite, through either gradual change or more violent change. So they are no longer in charge of the rules, and the rule setters become somebody else. Crony capitalism is a clear example of exactly that situation. The cronies are not going to change the rules. They're the ones that are benefiting from it. The second conundrum is how to engage in reconstructing a polity and incentives and yet not interfere in the internal affairs of the country which is riven by corruption. And this goes to Article 4, Section 10 of the bank's charter. Don't interfere in the internal political events of the clients. Well, if you're not going to interfere in the internal political events of the clients, and the political masters of the clients are directing and benefiting from the corruption, a little bit hard to get your handle on that, I think. So it seems to me inevitably the donors, to the extent that they're going to involve themselves truly in anti-corruption, are going to have to get involved in internal political and other events and other core interests of the recipient countries. And it's not as though they don't already. After all, structural adjustment, a whole variety of other bank programs were designed precisely to change the nature of the internal political and economic, the political economy of the country. So to isolate the political dimension of this and say, sure, the bank can get involved in the economic affairs of the borrowers, but not the political affairs of the borrowers, is, it seems to me, to create an artificial dividing line between politics and economics, when in fact in the real world there isn't really a dividing line. The politics and the economics go hand in hand, precisely in the countries that are most affected by corruption. The third and final conundrum has to do with the donors themselves, and it has to do with Dr. Kim's talk about having zero corruption, zero tolerance for corruption. And this, I think, is also a political economy point. If the bank, the World Bank, or any other bilateral donor were a private operator in the market, it would tolerate a certain level of corruption in exchange for a reduction in the monitoring effort. Put differently, if you want to reduce corruption to zero, you're going to have a lot of monitors. The guardians are going to have to be there. Who guards the guardians, as Plato said? Who guards the guardians who guard the guardians who guard the guardians? Pretty soon, you wind up, at least in public donors, bilateral as well as multilateral, with such a complicated internal bureaucratic system to contain a relatively modest amount of corruption, that if you were in the private sector, you would never do that. You would say, okay, there's a business loss for a certain amount of corruption, but they can't take the public hit. The public hit from exposure of corruption in the government or the multilateral donors is too hard for them to sustain, and therefore they wind up with these Rube Goldberg kind of bureaucratic attempts to reduce the corruption, the internal corruption. Not a bad thing to, of course you want to reduce internal corruption, but like every other element of corruption, that's a cost-benefit risk analysis that ought to be taken into account. So it seems to me, I'll close with this, that we need to look at the larger private, the larger political economy when we think about corruption. What is the nature of that political economy? And to me, I realize this may be tuning my own horn here, good governance is important, but where does good governance come from? I think ultimately it has to come from a democratic form of government. I don't think you can get corruption reduction with a couple of exceptions. Everybody's going to tell me Singapore, so if we could avoid the Singapore question very unique case. I know Singapore very well. I did my dissertation in Malaysia. It was Malaysia and Singapore were connected. I know Singapore. Please, let's not talk about Singapore. One case out of 197. The rest of them, if you don't have a democratic system with countervailing sources of power that people talked about before, I don't see how you're going to get a control of the political economy which lies at the base of corruption. Last point. People talk a lot about civil society and advocacy, and in my experience, they talk about it in places of semi-authoritarian and authoritarian states where the people who are in power couldn't give up rat's bum about the advocacy of some civil society organization.
That's a think tank term, right?
That is a think tank term. About a civil society. Advocacy depends on what lever you have to bear on the group to which you are advocating. And that, it seems to me, also is much enhanced by a democratic form of government where the civil society organizations can go to the public and where there is a real cost for corruption. Thank you.
Jerry, thanks very, very much. Ian Solomon is the U.S. Executive Director at the World Bank. Thank you, Ian, for being on this panel. Ian, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Daniel, and thank you very much for thanks CSIS, and thank all of you for being here. I see a lot of friends in this crowd. I hope we're not all just talking to our friends here. We're going to make sure that people are watching. But I was watching on the webcast and saw how quickly you got your coffee break and got a better rush over here. Watching outside as well. So hopefully others who may not all agree with us. But I think there are areas we don't all necessarily agree here, too, and I want to push on that a little bit. But thank you very much. And I also won't repeat Gerald's data, and we've talked a lot about the costs and the stakes that can be hard. I won't repeat that, but I do just want to remind us of who are the ultimate victims we should be most worried about. It's generally, corruption favors the elite over the vulnerable. So if this really is about worrying about the poorest and the most vulnerable, that's really what we need to keep in mind here, whether it's when mining revenues get lost, yes, there may be some corporate interests that are disadvantaged, but really it's the people of those countries who fail to benefit from their natural assets. When fake pharmaceuticals flood the streets, we saw the Washington Post report on this past week, who's the victims of these fake pharmaceuticals? It's the poor people who don't have access to alternatives. So that really is what I want to keep in mind. And I think, yes, we've talked about how complex the issue of corruption is, and I think Kaushik mentioned a number of reasons, and the complications of political economy. And clearly, you know, Gerald, I agree that it may be true that democracy is necessary to truly get rid of corruption. I'm not sure it's sufficient. There are many examples of democracies that also have a struggle with corruption. So we can't wait around until we have perfect democratic systems before we can kind of get to work, because we have all the important work to do, you know, protecting people and improving people's lives. And I think the way that I see the work of the World Bank and I see the overall effort against corruption is three interlinking ways we need to approach this issue. First, and this has been talked about and it goes to the hit card formula, but we need to strengthen the accountability from the bottom up. We need to, what we call sometimes, and I think it's Sanjay, there's lots of friends here from the FBI, the demand side accountability. Who is going to hold these leaders accountable, even in imperfect systems? Second is, how do we improve the governance capacity of both the public and private institutions in the countries we work in, these institutions that affect people's lives? And third is, how do we, as third parties often in these situations, as either donors or, in the case of the World Bank, major multilateral bodies, how do we police ourselves in this process and hold ourselves accountable? Again, to make sure we're benefiting the people on the ground. And then how do we also, if we are raising standards, make sure we are not just speaking to ourselves, but these standards are spreading more broadly across other development partners. So let me start from the bottom up and the demand side of accountability. And I think the bank has come a very long way, thanks to a lot of innovation from different people here, to really try to strengthen the ability of people to hold their governments accountable. And I think this addresses your first conundrum, which is, we need to empower the citizens themselves to hold their leaders accountable. And this is not just on issues of integrity, which is critical, but also hold their leaders accountable on the quality of service delivery. These governments are borrowing in the names of their citizens, and are they actually providing good services? Because, we're going to hold those citizens accountable to pay back these loans in many cases. So are they holding do they have the ability, and what tools can we help provide them with to better hold their leaders accountable? Well, clearly, the work to try to strengthen and innovate and expand the number of beneficiary feedback mechanisms is really important. It's not just whether or not the finance minister of one of our client countries is satisfied with the World Bank. It's whether the citizens who we aim to be supporting, either in their agricultural work or in their infrastructure work, do they believe that this is actually improving their lives? And some of the work we've done to take cell phone pictures and use SMS technology to say, take a picture of the road. Let's see if it actually meets our standard. How do we, again, empower the people on the ground to provide us that feedback? The work improving access to data. How is a citizen going to hold their leaders accountable if they don't know what money is being borrowed and where it's supposed to go? And the work the bank has done to support governments providing more access to the data, and the work requiring governments to publish their budgets if they're going to receive budget support, I think it's important to, again, give more tools to people on the ground to hold their leaders accountable. And I think this, your disclosure recommendations, Dev, are quite valuable. How do we get more out there? Because, yes, we're not going to have perfect systems, but if people know what assets their elected leaders hold, they at least have an opportunity to do something about it, whereas they might not without that information. I think the work the bank is doing piloting direct support to civil society organizations, again, perhaps in imperfect democracies, but how do we train these civil society organizations to use some of this data to hold their leaders accountable? We see a lot of important work in this country at the state and federal level here, people who know how to actually use budget data to say, hey, this demonstrates the priorities of this government through the data and by supporting and building the capacity of these civil society organizations. I think it's critically important to support the private sector here. And this gets to part of the monopoly part of the conundrum. How do we increase competition for providing some of these services, again, to give consumers and citizens more choice, again, to hold accountable with where they get their services? And I think a strong private sector is a very important counterweight to government and certainly to a non-responsive, corrupt government. I think one exciting innovation that the U.S. has supported with help from the World Bank is an open government partnership. So how do we get governments in the world to get together? And now over 50 partners, voluntary commitments, but working with civil society and private sector to make commitments to how they're going to make themselves more accountable. And the U.S. is part of this, too, and we've made a number of things with regard to our extractive industries legislation we've done in the U.S., our signing on to the International Aid Transparency Initiative, ways that even the U.S. can make itself far more transparent and accountable to our citizens. I recently attended the launch of the Open Gov Hub. I think the first of probably many Open Gov Hubs. I see Jean-Louis Sarbe there. Here's a way where government innovators can get together, co-locate together, figure out how do we help improve in different countries, share knowledge across, so we can all help push governments to make more data available. So this is sort of the way, how do we increase the demand side, the bottom-up accountability to combat corruption? In addition to the bottom-up, there's the important work of supporting the public and private institutions and the institution buildings. And I think the World Bank is one of the leading providers of technical assistance on the public sector governance question. And you're right, Dev, and Jim was right about how governance is, you know, it's the absence of good governance that really is the hotbed for corruption and makes it ripe for corruption. And the bank is, you know, has certainly lent a fair amount of money, provide a lot of analytical support, trying to improve public sector governance and everything from, you know, supporting judicial reforms. And I see David Bernstein there, and work on kind of strengthening the rule of law in countries and legal institutions. The work on more transparency and accountability for the extractive sector, improving procurement functions. And when people have the data and they discover something is wrong, what do they do about it? Is there someone they can complain to? Is there a mechanism? Is there an institution? Is there the administrative capacity for them to seek and obtain redress if they've been wronged? And I think this, and also institution building, includes the private sector as well. The IFC's performance standards, and trying to both get beneficiaries of IFC investments and recipients of IFC investments to raise their own standards, but also to raise the standard of the industry, because the private sector does benefit when the rules are clear and fair for all. I talked about the bank group's work on rule of law and the justice for the poor. Again, if we want to empower the poor to be able to speak for themselves, we need to have institutions that enable them to do that. I think the way we support global initiatives like the Extractive Industry Transparency Initiative, again, it's not just the bank itself, but again, a global agreement that involves many international partners and domestic civil society organizations, again, in this long, hard struggle to open things up more and have greater accountability, the Stolen Assets Recovery Initiative. Another lever where I think we probably could do more is strengthening regional bodies. If you look at their efforts to improve regional trade in parts of East Africa, where I travel with another one of my friends there, Robin, you know, the costs of trade are far higher because of problems at the borders of neighboring countries and corruption at the borders. If you travel through, many of you have, I'm sure, we often travel in these nice UN-plated vehicles that get to drive past all the checkpoints. If we're actually delivering some vegetables we wanted to sell, we'd have to stop at all of them. Our costs would go up, and it would actually have a great toll on the overall society. And that's another, I guess, to the second conundrum, you know, is who can hold accountable. Well, maybe you're right. We can't always from the outside. But some of the neighbors of these countries might be able to. So if we have, as we see, better leaders in many of the African countries, are they doing enough to hold their neighbors accountable and to help push their neighbors to reduce corruption? Another area where I'm not sure we've done enough, and this is one I think we ought to explore more, is whether the diaspora can play a role here strengthening institutions against corruption. You know, whether it's work on diaspora bonds or other things, but there are a lot of money that flow into many of these countries through remittances. If that community organized in some way and said, actually, we want to see certain sets of standards before we provide these remittances or before we support these bonds, maybe there's another form of leverage there to get at some of these conundrums of authority. So in addition to the institution building and the demand side, what is the World Bank itself doing? How do we police ourselves? How do we take responsibility for our own human and financial resources? And I think this takes a number of forms to try to deter and prevent corruption, but also when that doesn't work, to mitigate, punish it, and make an example of it. And the U.S., you know, looks at all parts of this effort to police ourselves and hold ourselves accountable. We take very seriously the policies and practices around procurement. Do we have open bidding, transparent processes around procurement? So when World Bank resources are lent to a country, that country uses those resources, how are they using them to procure goods and services? We've remained very cautious about the use of a country's own procurement systems, unless and until we can be confident that those country systems have a sufficient quality to prevent corruption. to meet global integrity standards. This is a big debate we have in the institution, but we want to support those country systems, but we want to raise their standard, make sure they actually can help prevent corruption, because if we're using those systems, then we're accountable for how those resources get used. We're also strong proponents, as Dev knows well and the IFC teams know well, for very stringent due diligence efforts before we make investments. Are we looking at politically exposed persons in entities in which you want to invest? Because you know, we understand how the political economy does work, so as we use our resources, are we paying close attention to that? It doesn't mean we can always get it perfect, but I think these are the questions we have to keep asking. We also strongly support Lennon McCarthy and Steve and the Integrity Vice Presidency within the World Bank to investigate allegations of fraud and corruption in bank finance projects, and also the work to try to take some of that information on a preventive side and help teams structure projects with lower risk for fraud and corruption. And the effort with Pascal and her team on sanctions, how do we make sure that if a company or a vendor is guilty or there is strong enough evidence that there is fraud or corruption, that they cannot participate in more World Bank bidding? And not just if they cheat or lie to the World Bank, how do we make sure that they can't get any benefits or can't work with the other MDBs as well? And this is really good work trying to cross the bar, and again, trying to create an institutional framework where we all raise the standards against corruption. The work on the International Corruption Hunters Alliance that's been done, again, trying to create a broader community about this. So again, we're not just talking to ourselves, but there is a broader network. And there are, of course, other accountability mechanisms within the bank group designed to ensure that shareholders, stakeholders, and other people affected by bank practice can hold the bank accountable, whether it's through the inspection panel mechanism or other ways that if you feel something's been wrong, there is a vehicle, because who is policing the police? And that is an important question. We need to find ways to democratize the process of policing the police as best we can. May not be perfect, but it's an important step. So, to conclude, the problem of corruption is not going away, and in fact, there are some troubling signs of increasing number and sophistication of efforts at corruption. So we all must stay vigilant. And I think that what I hope we can see is as much innovation as we hope to see on development around efforts to provide greater demand-side accountability. Let's innovate around demand-side accountability. Let's innovate around institution building. And let's innovate around the ways we police ourselves to make sure that all resources are used responsibly. Thank you.
Thanks, Ian. I thought there were some very interesting comments that I wanted to ask the panelists to respond to, or also to give you all each a chance to respond to some of your other colleague panelists, because I think there have been a number of provocative and constructively provocative things that I've put on the table. I don't often hear the word morality at CSIS conferences or in it's sort of implicit in a lot of the development conversation, but several folks have used the term morality. And oftentimes you'll get some pushback from folks saying, well, you don't understand, this is a cultural difference. Or I think a lot of that's, for the most part, been gone away around sort of, this is how we've always done things. Could folks respond to that, or they could also respond to other folks' comments? But I'd be curious about this issue of, oh, you don't understand, in our cultural context, we're different. I think, for the most part, that's been blown up, but I'd be interested in folks' comments on that. The second thing is, this issue of, in essence, we're asking folks to be involved in the political life of societies. This touches a lot of the political lives of societies. It's been referenced on this panel, this issue of how the bank gets involved in the internal politics, another word that I don't hear a lot around sort of conversations around the World Bank. How do you balance that? Because in essence, much of this work is implicitly political, and a lot of development work is implicitly political. So I'd be curious about how we talk about that. How does the bank talk about this, or from your varying perspectives, how do you speak about this in a way that is acceptable to folks when you're saying, I'm going to go in and fix, we're going to fix something that's innately political? And then I think the final point is I'd love if folks would comment on this issue of democratic governance. I mean, I'll put my cards on the table. CSIS and the Center for American Progress have just we organized an op-ed in Politico about 10 days ago. Madeleine Albright signed it, and John Podesta signed it along with Vin Weber and myself, talking about the importance of the United States staying involved in democracy promotion and supporting good governance as a bilateral donor at a time when this is under pressure. And we have about 20 prominent Republicans and Democrats who signed this document. So I certainly agree, Jerry, I think in the long run about this issue of of going towards democratic governance. I think it'd be very, I'd be interested in hearing from a multilateral development bank's perspective, given that perhaps we have to be a little bit more, you all have to be a little bit more agnostic, but you can either speak from an institutional standpoint, knowing that this is on the record, or you know, you could speak in your personal standpoint about this issue of democratic governance. Is that the direction? I certainly think so. Is that the direction that we need to go? Obviously, we can think of cities and state governments in this country that are innately famous for being corrupt in the United States. So it's not as if we're perfectly clean in that respect. But I'd be curious about that point as well. I'll stop there. And I'll open up to my colleagues. Yes, sir, Dr. Basu.
Dan, thank you very much. Let me talk to the second one first. And actually, this relates a little bit to what Ian was saying. Corruption favors the elite. And in fact, if you want to put it more bluntly, corruption blocks the escape route from poverty of the poor. It keeps them there. And there is one problem here, Jerry, which sort of intertwines with the democracy. And I think it's just immensely valuable democracy. It builds up pressure, which ultimately does deliver, but there is that lag. And why does it take long to deliver? One reason is, I think, related to this, that there is at times an implicit cross-party collusion. There are some matters in which you get cross-party collusion because the people at the top constitute the elite and the interests tend to come together. And that's why you do need the civil society activism, grassroots activism, which shows that you're upset with not just the government but the people who keep interchanging powers, but it is the elite that it remains with. And you need this engagement of society. With that, there is a lot of design problem as to how you do it. And here I'll come into the morality question. I do bring it up in this discussion, always feeling a bit self-conscious. It sounds like a school moral science lecture. But, you know, I feel economics just gives too little room to morality. Morality not in a textbookish sense, but human beings are endowed with all kinds of values. And also it's not that fundamentally anything is genetically wired into you. Depending on your experience, on your history, you are endowed with certain values. And corruption flourishes or does not flourish depending a lot on these fundamental values that people carry. In the end, the problem of who polices the policeman would get easier if everyone collectively carries certain values. And this, at one level, sounds very childish. How will you do that? It's fine to say that we should carry some values that we will never engage in bribery. But is that possible? Because there is self-interest. But, you know, this is what textbooks have done, and there is this beautiful set of experiments done by Tom Gilovich and Bob Frank, and I think that is a third author, where you make people play games where you can be more selfish or less selfish. And it was discovered that economists, students of economics, who have been students of economics for a while, usually play these games more selfishly than others. And my view, these were just experimental results, very widely reported. The Economist had talked about it. My view is that it is not that there is a fundamental difference between these students and others. These students read books where you're being continuously told that human beings are endlessly selfish. And we are, in the end, conformists. We tend to be like the world is in general. And I think they play the game that they are being told that people play. So what you learn, what you see around, which is to do with things like values, which do matter. You know, Kenneth Arrow, one of the gurus in my discipline, and has written a lot on the power of the market economy, also points out that without a modicum of altruism, a market economy would not survive. You need those in place, and it is possible to nurture those once you appreciate the importance of this. The one example which actually to me is most striking, not smoking in a public place. When this began, this culture that, look, you may be better off smoking because you like to smoke, but you're going to inflict collateral damage on lots of other people. You wonder, first of all, in a society where if it's completely driven by self-interest, short of having policemen who will nab you, will you ever get this value in place? And I used to earlier think that even if you manage in industrialized societies, India is a much more, culturally anarchic society, let me put it that way. You will never get it in place in India. But, you know, this changed over a very short period. Smoking in public places is gone. And it's to do with it. It's still in your self-interest to light up, and in lots of places there are no signs, there need not be rules, but it's become a habit. You don't light up in a public place with other people. The fact that this changed means that not only are we endowed with values and norms, And these norms and values can change a lot. And I think economics has done injustice by keeping our attention away from this very, very important thing. So, Dan, I'm glad you brought it up.
Thank you, Dr. Bissett.
I just want to pick up on one or the two items that were brought up on the political economy and democracy, because I definitely see where you're coming from, Gerald, with regards to the importance of engaging in the discussion in the political economy, because I face it all the time, whether I'm dealing with a client country that is trying to improve its investment climate environment, for example, right, or a client country that is asking for our assistance on a strategy on industry. Right? How do they make their industries more competitive, and so on? And in all of these, you can't get away, right, from the political economy dimensions, right, of how you do get to be more competitive, or how you can make improvements in the investment climate arena. But the bank obviously is not going to be participating directly in the political process, but where I see the bank has been incredibly effective and can potentially do even more is in bringing knowledge to bear, right, about the political economy dimensions. Right? Now, it's interesting that you mentioned you singled out Singapore, by the way. I grew up in Singapore. So before coming to this democracy, I was in another democracy, arguably. Now, the reason why I bring that up is that a number of our client countries are interested in the Singapore lessons or the lessons from other countries, even the political economy questions, and the bank does have an obligation to figure out, you know, what has worked and what hasn't in these places, and bring them, you know, openly to our clients. In the Singapore case, because I was born, you know, just before the Singapore gained its independence from Britain, and in those early years, there were huge challenges in trying to tackle corruption. Singapore was known more as a sin city, right, than what it is right now. And corruption was having its heyday in the 60s and 70s, and there were very interesting lessons in terms of how leadership approached it. You may agree or disagree, right, with the political system of a particular country, but there were very interesting lessons in terms of how leadership held themselves accountable, right, in how they tried to fix the problem. And these may not be directly applicable, you know, to country X, Y, and Z, because I don't think they're typically best practices, but they can be good practices, right, in terms of how, lessons could be learned. That's one aspect. The other thing that I think we could do a lot more of, there are lots of good stories on how countries, you know, have dealt with issues. I was in an interesting mission one day with my colleague Sri Mulyani in the bank, and we were in the Philippines and several other countries, and the stories that she could bring to light, right, on specific experiences that the country that she hailed from, Indonesia, obviously, had done, right, to correct issues in corruption, whether it was in the reform of the Customs Bureau or on trade. There are a number of these stories that I don't think we have captured well enough in order to to really share widely. So this is an arena that I think the bank, as well as other multilateral institutions, could be spending more of their investment dollars in developing and disseminating such information, such that you can have the political economy discussion. I don't think that's avoidable.
Jerry.
Thank you. I think I really had my say, so I'll be extremely brief. Number one, I wanted to throw a couple of conceptual grenades here. Things are obviously more complicated, but it seems to me that, as Weber said, you got to start with some archetypes and then see where things differ from them. That's a good way to think about where to go, rather than just completely getting muddled in the intricacies of complications. So that's number one. Number two, democracy is by no means a fix-it, but I think it is the best necessary condition that I can see. And when you talk about it, it isn't just the industrial countries. It's not just because they're industrial that they have low corruption. They also are democratic. And when you look at Costa Rica and Botswana, again, the same thing. The countries that have low rates of corruption tend also to be democracies. I don't say it's perfect, and Singapore is the obvious example, the counterexample to that. But I think it does track pretty closely. Thirdly, on the question of justice and fairness and morality and how people respond to corruption, I know people have said in a lot of places that poor people in lots of countries, corruption is just part of the norm. Everybody expects it. Nobody has really outrage about it. That has not been my experience. I think when people talk about that, what they mean is it's normal to expect corruption. It is also deeply offensive in a lot of places, and not just in Western industrial countries. You go to Afghanistan, one of the poorest countries in the world, and one of the things you hear constantly is the injustice of the government, the corruption of the government, the failure to deal with the fact that people, especially poor people, have to pay out of their pockets for things that they know are not right. I think if you ask the question about justice, you will get a very different answer than if you ask people whether corruption is the norm in the society and whether they expect it or not. I think a lot of people expect corruption and find it deeply offensive. That's been my experience. Lastly, Sri Mulyani comes from Indonesia, which has been trying a really noble experiment brought out precisely after the Democratic Revolution in the Corruption Eradication Commission. That commission has itself been under attack. And it's been under attack precisely by the vested interests in the political economy in Indonesia that don't want it to succeed. So the problem, I don't have any problem at all, obviously, with transparency, accountability. How do you create accountable institutions? But in order for them to be accountable, there's got to be a lever, I think. There's got to be something that makes them do things that they wouldn't otherwise do. And the attraction, personal attraction of corruption, the benefit to me is great. And you can justify that along a variety of ways, but it seems to me, to be some kind of lever that is a counter lever to the maximization of benefit, which is what the sort of primary economic motive might well be.
Ian, before I ask you to speak, I wanted to just get Dr. Basu and Dev's response to just what Jerry said. Or anything else? You were going to say something else, Deb.
I just wanted to jump in very briefly with a comment on Singapore, given that there is one Singapore specialist, one person was born in Singapore. You need the objectivity of someone who's been there for a total of 4 days. so let me just comment on this.
Did you chew bubble gum and put it on the sidewalk? I hope you didn't do that.
Right.
I think actually both these points are, to me, totally valid. One thing is that dictatorship in some sense gives you a latitude of or dictatorial control of behaviors from where you can get 1 out of 100 good results because someone does that right. But the risk is just huge when there is so much totalitarian control at the top. So I think the data that 1 out of 100 may have succeeded is perfectly compatible with that is a route just not worth going because there is the risk of the other 99%. There's another thing, is that once you get into that mode, to switch to a successful market economy is a very difficult transition. And there again, I think it's one out of 1,000 that will manage to make that switch. And there are lots of countries which from totalitarian control will first get into a complete collapse before they again recover. And there are lots of examples from history. But after I joined the World Bank, I was told not to name countries because EDs will object. So I will not name any countries.
Dev, do you want to just comment on that? I want to ask, like, Ian, floor is yours.
Thank you. No, certainly democratic governance is a core part of U.S. development policy. And the, you know, the policy directive on development basically says broad-based economic growth and democratic governance are at the core of what we're trying to achieve. And I certainly think that in my role as ED at USED at the bank, want to find ways to support and encourage governance in this respect, but know that nowhere will it succeed if we try to impose it. We can't impose democratic governance. It has to kind of, you know, be nurtured and encouraged. And I think we need to see it not as a discrete condition of, okay, now we check a box for democratic governance, but really a continuum. And countries can be more, have more and more democratic institutions or less and less. And one of the things we try to do, whether it's through Millennium Challenge Corporation or others, how do we look at where countries are on a spectrum of democratic institutions and governance? And are they getting better? In which case, maybe we can encourage them and provide more support with the hopes that they'll achieve better development results. And if they're actually moving in the wrong direction, how do we increase pressure? Because I agree with everything Jerry said. And it's actually, yes, we need a lever, but we actually probably need multiple levers from all different ways to encourage them. So I think we do need to find ways to encourage a change. And I think that thinking of it as a continuum and knowing we need to support it, you know, I think we need to figure out how do we find ways, what can we do to support conditions for progress along this continuum, whether it's through increased transparency, improving education, trying to grow a middle class that has expectations of good quality service delivered to them. How do we strengthen institutions of justice? How do we strengthen civil society and more voices in this debate? How do we find ways to, you know, build the private sector increase the number of voices in this argument for greater service? Now, I don't see a single bullet. I think it is a process, and I think we have seen great progress in a number of countries along this dimension. But also, you know, it's as you said, Dev, countries are looking at multiple models for guidance.
All right, we've got a lot of thoughtful people here, and I see a lot of hands. I'm going to first call on my friend Mr. Bond, who's up here, who used to be at the bank, used to be at IFC, used to be at MIGA. So, James, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dan. You make me sound like a has-been. Thank you very much. Look, I loved this panel. It was very interesting, and all of the panelists agree that information is very important and creating civil society, the sort of demand for governance. So we all agree on that. And Gerald came up with a nice formula, which is corruption is a monopoly plus discretion plus low accountability. I don't think the monopoly is right. I think it's actually rent. And I want to zero on a specific sector and a specific area, and that is resource rents from oil, gas, and mining. And the area, let's take Africa, for example, which often has the sort of discretion and low accountability. Now, there is, of course, the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, EITI. Over half the countries that have signed up are African, but actually it's a good first step, but it's woefully inadequate because it's simply the funds flow from the resources, and it's not absolutely clear what payments are made. Now, the Centennial Group, which is sort of one of these consulting companies in town, has been taking a look at contract terms for oil, gas, and mining in Africa and tried to compare these to terms in other parts of the world. And there are two things that have come out. The first is it's almost impossible to get the information. And the second is when you do get the information, it's clear that Africa is getting a raw deal in terms of the sharing of the rent. Now, of course, they could get a raw deal because perhaps they don't have the capacity to negotiate well, you know, although they can always get law firms to do it for them, or they don't have the information, but they can always buy it. But it also is perhaps because of the side payments that are being paid. And, of course, this is going to completely change the negotiating stance. And so the oil, gas, and mining companies are going to get a better deal for themselves, more of the rent, in exchange for a kind of a side payment to somebody in power. Now, does this exist? It's impossible to say based on the data, but you just have to look at Angola. Ike, by the way, Kashik, and no longer at the bank, so I can actually quote companies. Angola countries, Nigeria, Democratic Republic of Congo, to say that side payments are definitely likely, and you can see the kind of development impact they have. Now, the reason I'm raising this is because, you know, we've been talking mostly public finance. How can you get the World Bank money not to be corrupt? How can you get... But actually, it seems to me that where there's the kind of resource rent, there's probably a far higher degree of corruption in society and might well undermine the kind of regular bank type or USAID or work involved. And I'm wondering whether there isn't much more of an effort that needs to be made, say, through legislation, through OECD, through sort of have a kind of Foreign Corrupt Practices Act extended to countries like Angola, Nigeria, and so on, to try to get a handle on this resource rent associated corruption. One final comment, and then I'll give it back. For those of you who've read the Dodd-Frank legislation, I'm sure you've all read it, there's actually a clause in there about Coltran, and I'm sure none of you know what Coltran is, but you all have it in your cell phones in the form of a rare earth that's used for... There's actually a clause in there that says that any company that actually whose product depends on Coltran has to actually have an audit done of the supply channels for Coltran to see whether they're not fueling conflict in the Eastern Congo. I mean, it's a bit of a weird clause to have in the Dodd-Frank legislation, but it's there. Now, how come you have that for Coltran, which represents at most perhaps 10 kilograms per year, and we don't have much more of an effort made on greater transparency in oil, gas, and mining, copper, cobalt, and the like?
Thank you, James. Okay, Ian, you first, please.
Just wanted to, I think James make an excellent point, and we miss you at the bank group, so good to see you. But Dodd-Frank also does actually include language on oil, and holding U.S. or companies that want to trade on U.S. exchanges have to publish a significant portion of their information. I'm not sure of all the details of whether it's the full contracts or just certain aspects of the payments they make for oil and perhaps some other natural resources as well. But it's more than just Coltran. But I think that is a way of at least the U.S. trying for U.S. firms to provide greater accountability for extractive industry transactions.
Okay. Simin Dorsaif was you were the executive director at the Asian Development Bank in the Clinton administration.
That's right, and currently at Johns Hopkins University. And I am interested that a lot of the discussion has talked about successes. And so we talk about policies that are in place, policing mechanisms, the availability of data, and then certain frustrations that are there. How do we get reliable data? How do we change the incentive system? And we've gotten into a lot of philosophy. Let's not impose values from the outside. I think all of these are very important points. And then, Kaushik, to your point, you're absolutely right. EDs, you know, having been one myself, do get quite disturbed if you mention things that are not working very well. But on the other hand, I think that they're very pleased when you talk about things that work well. And so there have been a lot of examples of shining successes around the world. Without naming names or without naming countries, this is something that I think would be very valuable to share. What are some of your greatest frustrations in terms of moving this agenda ahead without necessarily naming a specific country, but rather describing it in terms of the issue that was the frustration?
And Kaushik, maybe perhaps Dev, you might also comment on this as well.
You know, it relates to the power and not adequate power of democratic institutions. And that's, you would expect that that's going to deliver very quickly. And there are examples galore that you get those institutions in place. You get a very, very vibrant media in place. But you don't get that to deliver very quickly. That, to me, is the biggest frustration because both these are in themselves just... qualities that you want in a society, a vibrant democracy, vibrant media. And you would expect that to deliver on things like this. That does not automatically deliver, which is where I feel you need to burrow in with. And since you're at the university, you also need a bit of research on how do we hand over to these very, very powerful forces thoughts about the way to go about. Because democracy usually garners good forces. But the ideas have to come actually from somewhere else, and very often from universities, research groups that come up with ideas, make it available to the democratic forces so that they can then carry with these ideas and take them forward. I feel we need a lot of work on that. And it is also to do with the, you know, the minutiae of these structures of decision-making. If you have too many overlapping decision-making domains in a democracy, I feel that does not work very well. Whereas if you have structures where everybody has a say, but it is partitioned into where I have a say and where someone else has a say, you get more effective functioning. And a very good example from a different domain, not corruption, is land right and the efficiency of land rights. When you have a land on which 30 people have rights and you need all of them to sign off before a transaction takes place, that transaction does not take place. Whereas if you have very widely dispersed rights, but each person with his or her own plot of land with a right, you have a much more thriving land market and a better functioning land market. So these structures of decision making, because democracy can be that everyone has a say on every decision, which is a very cluttered kind of democracy. Whereas if you can do an intelligent partitioning of domains over which different groups have different says. So these are things that need to be worked on. And this is stems from my frustration precisely because you see these excellent institutions not delivering as quickly as you would want them to deliver.
Very quickly, I see, you know, two frustrations that I constantly run into in what I need to deliver. One is, and I mentioned this earlier, it's the information problem. It's getting information out, right? And you mentioned it yourself, that because it is not just putting out information, but it's putting out information intelligently. In asset disclosure, for example, which I had mentioned, you know, even holding up to countries that this is the way your asset disclosure laws look like today. In other words, just reusing what knowledge is already out there, but then to be transparently conveying that out. And now it's easier said than done, right? Because you immediately run into the political economy issues of being challenged, you know, that you're making unfair comparisons and so on. The second frustration that I have is, you know, very often in the dialogue, in the partnership dialogue between the public sector and the private sector, it's been an antagonistic one, right? And it's, you can't, let me give you a very concrete example. You can't invite the private sector to a public forum and then bash them up, right? If you're going to try to get them, you know, to cooperate. You need to find a way of working with the private sector, you know, to solve the problems, whether in their dealings with PEPs or whether, you know, it's in the extractive resources environment that James brought in. The private sector has got a big role, but we need to change the tenor of and tone of the dialogue, right, with regards to how they can be a part of this thing. For those of you who have not read Michael Porter's latest works, it's called The Creating Shared Value, right? It offers some, I think, a very interesting avenue with regards to what the private sector ought to be, you know, portraying. It's not the CSR equivalent, right? The corporate social responsibility, where it's just down to philanthropic giving, but to make the private sector realize that this interventions in this directly intervenes their profitability positively. Right, and once that story is told, you get a much better dialogue going with the private sector.
My friend up here, Rachel.
Hi, I'm Edie Wilson, and I want to speak as an American citizen. And Puncher, it's a really good panel, but we do ourselves a disservice in governance and anti-corruption when we fall into this, oh, the rich countries are better, and democracy is better. And first, I'd love to see some empirical evidence on that, and particularly when we get self-congratulatory about the United States. To many people around the world, I would posit, who I visit with on Facebook and RS, they were appalled by our last recent election. They find political corruption rampant in the United States at the moment, and they find a political system that is not transparent, that has a broken Federal Election Commission, that has a lack of transparency, that had very odd decisions by our highest court. And so when we think we're doing well, I first would think that maybe we'd been in Washington too long and accepted. No, I mean, it's very easy to accept the reality that you're part of it. Just looks nice and normal. And when we do so, it prevents us from asking some even more important questions, which is, with the growth of democracy, how are we paying for political party activity? When Richard Thornburg was Attorney General of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, the case that made him governor was his prosecution of a Rhodes case. And that Rhodes case, the kickbacks, were going to the Democratic Party. All right? That is actually a classic INT case study from a couple of years ago in Latin America. The money wasn't going to line private sector pockets. It was going to help pay local elections. So until we're willing to have a discussion about political funding, rise of democracy, and corruption, I'm not sure we're going to really get there.
Okay. Do you want to comment on that? Jerry?
Yeah. Why don't we just stipulate? First of all, I don't think anyone mentioned the United States on the whole panel. Second is, I think we should stipulate that this country is in deep trouble in its democracy. I look at the budget situation. Third is, I think all the democracies, industrial democracies, are in deep trouble. The question from the larger perspective is, what's the alternative? And one possible alternative is Singapore. But as as Kaushik put it very well, 0.5% doesn't get you very far. And so the question is, what are the mechanisms of accountability? And one of the questions of one of the mechanisms is competitive elections. It's not the only one, but it's one of them. It's the counterpart to a free market, where you also want competitive market structures. If you have competition, and you have, then you are more likely, rather than less likely, to get accountability. So no one's talking. I don't think anyone. I didn't hear anybody say the U.S. was some kind of paragon. I think we're in deep trouble. But from a larger perspective, what is the better alternative to that?
Deb, do you want to comment on Ian?
Look, just very, very quickly. I actually appreciate the where you're coming from on this whole area. I mean, in the many discussions that I've had, right? When we begin to simplify the debate, right, to one which is a democracy or not, you've already lost the debate, right? Frankly, I can challenge you, right? Whether you go to the where the country that I did come from. I'm proudly American right now, but you know, I really enjoyed growing up in Singapore as well. But if you go to the Singaporeans and if you go to even China, right, and begin talking about comparisons of democracy, you're going to lose the debate, right, with them, because they don't see it, you know, in that way. I've had discussions with a number of young Chinese in Shanghai, where I lived, you know, for several years, right? And they talk about, you know, what is pragmatic? What can we do to make pragmatic changes? They don't believe, you know, that their government is right or so, nor do they simplify the discussion to it just being, you know, a question of degrees of democracy, because I don't think that goes anywhere. So I see where you're coming from, and I actually appreciate it, because I think the discussion needs to go way beyond, right, the level of forms of political structure.
Ian.
I just feel the need to say that I actually am not going to stipulate that U.S. democracy is in big trouble. I just don't accept that stipulation, because I'm not sure it's relative to what. What I will say is that I agree, Ian, and your dear friend, that we can improve our institutions and our elections and our funding process, absolutely. And this goes to Zinnemann's question about kind of what are the frustrations. It's that I think we, as an institution, as a field, as an industry of development, have not always been really willing to kind of talk about how we learn from mistakes and how we learn from failure and how we continually improve. And I think one of the encouraging things about Jim Kim is doing at the bank was actually trying to have more of a discussion about let's learn from failure. Let's admit that we have things that we need to do better, that we haven't done well, where mistakes have been made, and try to have a more transparent, open discussion about it. Now, it is hard in our multilateral system, but I think it's an important step forward, and we can do it all in our own democracies, in our own countries, but also throughout the multilateral system and in the field of development.
Coming up front here, just the microphone.
Thank you very much. Abdulrahim Fukara from Al Jazeera. As you know, corruption gets a bad rap in North Africa and the Middle East, equaled only by the bad rap that the international economic system, buttressed in the IMF and the World Bank, gets. Ironically, the Muslim Brotherhood has not challenged any of the basic tenets of the international economic system, although the revolution had been carried out in the name of dignity, social and economic justice. My question is there life outside the international economic system as we know it today? And you talked about morality. If you rule in the name of religion, whether it's Islam, Christianity, Judaism, or any other religion, are you a better candidate or a worse candidate for dealing with the issue of corruption? Thank you.
Wow. Okay. Dr. Basu, do you want to...
You know, just a one-line, I can't, lots of things to your question. Religious morality and morality, to me, actually, it does not really matter. There are certain fundamental traits which allow a society to function, and those elements of a moral system which could be lodged in a religious system, which could be a completely irreligious person with those morals, is what I was stressing. So I was really not attending to that. And it could be, as I'm saying, there could be religious systems where not all the morality strictures there, but some of them could be helping with the functioning of markets.
My sense is a lot of the Muslim Brotherhood technical leadership have MBAs and PhD economics degrees here from the United States and elsewhere. I think that means that there doesn't mean that there's a number of challenges but I'm sure, Dev, you must interact with the Egyptian government or have had some interactions with them on this topic. Can you speak to that?
We've had interactions with the Egyptian government, but at the moment, mainly on trying to figure out a way to be helpful to them in one particular area, and that is in the recovery, right, of assets. I won't say anything more than that at this stage. But you know, there's discussions that are ongoing.
Just quickly. It seems to me that the question is what's going to be the track record. And it seems to me that if you look historically at what the track records are, when you have authoritarian governments, whatever their original bases are, they wind up being exemplars of the old adage, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So the question will be, what is the Muslim Brotherhood government, if there is one, look like 5 years from now? And if you look at Iran as an example, corruption levels are quite high, notwithstanding the morality and the religious basis of essentially a theocracy. What's the long-term trajectory? I think if you look at the data over long-term, authoritarian and governments tend to wind up with a lot more corruption. It's a tendency, not a rule.
Is there life outside the international economic system as we know it today? I mean, communism obviously failed, but outside the capitalistic system, is there any hope, as Egyptians would call it, for their country now that they're trying to operate outside the stipulations of the World Bank and the IMF, at least the people who are protesting, not the government?
Okay, so an alternative economic model to participating in globalization a la... I'll put some countries on the table. North Korea and Cuba as exemplars of perhaps a better, that's not totally fair, but I get your point. But it may be that actually is an interesting question as well. Could the panel want to just respond to that?
I can touch on that. It's just very, very difficult. The world, economic world today is so intertwined. And the dependence on one another is so big. And that is a vehicle for doing well also. I mean, trade is a vehicle. This has been written about. Capital flows... This has made it possible for countries that were languishing to come up. These cause great difficulty, but it's important. So to me, if you remain cut off from this global economic system, it puts hurdles on a country which are absolutely huge. I won't use the word insurmountable because in life, I don't know, nothing may be insurmountable. There can be something which flourishes despite that. But in the long run, it's very difficult. And this goes back to Adam Smith's wisdom of 1776, that specialization is what leads to prosperity. You just do better and better as you specialize. And specialization means that at the level of individuals, groups, countries, you become better at something, someone else becomes better at something else, and you trade, you have exchange, and you do you thrive in that system. So I feel that it is virtually critical to remain integrated with the global system, and whether one likes it or not. So it's best for a country that does not like parts of the global system, the right strategy is to become a part of it and then try to exercise as much voice as one can instead of cutting oneself off totally. North Korea is a very, very good example. North Korea as an economy was not doing too badly in the early 70s, but such total isolation makes it virtually impossible, and the system crumbled.
Okay, this gentleman here, last question.
Thank you. I'm Akbar Khwaja. I'm a World Bank retiree and also a former senator from Pakistan. Thank you, Dr. Basu, for defining the corruption, and also Mr. Diwan, that authority minus accountability is a corrupt environment and so on. My question is actually focused more on the role of board in the World Bank. World Bank is a great institution. I always enjoyed the integrity of staff and the effectiveness and efficiency and so on. But the role of board of directors have been a question mark, particularly after President Paul Wolfowitz, when he was identified that there were corrupt practices. What action were taken that? And what are the lessons learned that it doesn't happen again? Thank you.
Okay.
Well, I wasn't there at the time when I've been there just under 3 years. But I think I think we as a board need to make sure that we have checks and balances on ourselves as well. The overriding question of who polices the police is an important one, and we need to make sure that we have appropriate ethics and integrity standards, and that kind of these same systems that would apply to recipients of World Bank funds and World Bank staff also apply. There's a system also to hold board members accountable and the board itself accountable. These are mechanisms I think we need to continue to work on. I see some of my colleagues on the board here, but I can't talk about the Wolfowitz matter. What I would say, though, is that many of us, I think most of us, do take these issues very seriously and do ourselves feel held accountable to very high standards.
Okay, please join me in thanking the panel. If we all agree to come back in 5 minutes, we'll take a 5-minute break, but be back here in 5 minutes, please. Okay, folks, we're going to get started.